You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
The total value of the crypto market recently passed through $2 trillion, a doubling since January when it first topped $1 trillion for the first time. There is a new wave of excitement, obviously, about cryptocurrencies after Bitcoin's rally. But S&P Global Ratings believe they continue to be speculative instruments instead of a means for commerce. In a report published on Thursday titled The Future of Banking, cryptocurrencies are still mostly about speculation, not payment. S&P analysts said they believe that regulators and much greater public confidence hold the key to more widespread use. That hasn't stopped the parabolic rise of Bitcoin and other coins year to date. And this week, we see Coinbase, the largest crypto exchange in America, is scheduled to go public via an IPO. Coinbase will list its shares directly on the NASDAQ, becoming the first publicly traded crypto exchange in the US. Coinbase thrived last year as investors poured into Bitcoin. In 2020, it made $1.2 billion in revenue and its first ever annual profit of just over $320 million. Satoshi would be proud, whoever he, she, they are. 12 years have passed since the mysterious Satoshi Nakamoto mined the first block of the Bitcoin chain, and crypto is now more relevant than ever. Coinbase expects that it has a whopping 56 million verified users, 6.1 million of which are trading monthly. Yet we still see exchanges failing, like Ameritrading International, ICE3, which posted an announcement on Monday that it had been advised to initiate liquidation proceedings after suspending all trading on the exchange in March following the discovery of account discrepancies. It's also suspended the withdrawal of client funds. And this comes just a week after informing clients that it would process withdrawal requests for all cryptos and rands, with the exception of Bitcoin and Litecoin. So where does this leave the long-run investment and use case for cryptos? Well, let's welcome our panelists to find out. Badi Sudhakaran, who is the co-founder and chief product officer of Valo.com. Anthony Rocky, co-founder of Rexilom, which is a boutique investment and asset manager with a specialization in cryptos. And Vian Ulifir, partner at the audit division of Mazars in South Africa. Now, Badi, if you look at it, I think blockchain technology is really interesting and will almost certainly become more important in the future. And I think I understand the finite supply of Bitcoin, the loss of faith in central banks, this whole store of value narrative. But, and it's a big but for me, I have absolutely no idea how to value cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. It could be cheap at $1 million and expensive at $5, and I wouldn't be able to put forward a coherent reason why. Just help me understand how you value something like Bitcoin.
Well, Michael, so just like any asset in the world, it is the price of Bitcoin is subject to the forces of supply and demand. So as you said, there's a finite supply of Bitcoin, about 21 million in total circulation once it comes into circulation. So as you can see, the many of the institutions in the world, financial institutions, they are changing the US dollars that they have on their balance sheet into Bitcoin. They see Bitcoin as a better store of value than US dollars. So you, as you know, that Tesla put in $1.5 billion into Bitcoin, and many corporations in the world are following suit. And I think because of the demand increasing and the supply staying the same, I think that is one of the reasons why we see Bitcoin's parabolic rise in price. Mm-hmm.
And to bring you in on that point, if you then look at it as a pure supply demand driven equation, what is driving that demand for Bitcoin? Is it pure frenzy, speculation, or belief that it has this this intrinsic store of value? How do you, as an asset manager, sit down and try and value something like a cryptocurrency?
Hi, Michael. I think firstly, I think we have to establish that Bitcoin, like other assets like gold, doesn't have an intrinsic value, and that shouldn't scare people, because gold has been around for a long time and it's never had an intrinsic value. And as the previous panelists pointed out, it's purely supply and demand. I think it's also worth noting that within the context of Bitcoin, Bitcoin is not a success by itself. It is a success in answer to what is happening with central bank policy. central banks the world over have chosen the path of debasements of fiat. And that path has been set. It's very hard to unwind the debasement, the QE programs. It will collapse markets and it will destroy a lot of value. So in answer to the debasement of fiat, we have noticed that a lot of assets, not just Bitcoin, but a lot of assets that have scarcity are being bid up. Properties, especially sea-facing properties, those are being bid up. Properties the world over in central cities are being bid up. And Bitcoin is just a part of that. Now, what makes Bitcoin different to, for instance, property is that it's so accessible. You can download an app on your phone, you can transfer some money, and you can be an owner of a fraction of a Bitcoin very easily and very quickly. That opportunity is denied a lot of people when it comes to even physical gold. In South Africa, we are spoiled. We can go to a gold broker and pick up a Kruger Rand. If you live overseas and you try and get your hands on physical gold, you're going to pay a big premium. So we have to remember that within the larger context, this is not just pure speculation. This is also an answer to what I see as the madness of the central banks.
Vian, looking at it from the regulatory perspective and through that particular lens at the moment, would you say that one of the keys to continuing adoption of cryptocurrencies actually lies in some form of light touch regulation to give it a little bit more confidence, to give the investor and the holder at the end of the day a bit more confidence? Because one of the key drivers to this point has always been the decentralization effects of a cryptocurrency and the fact that it largely operates outside of any one sovereign's regulatory reach.
Yeah, definitely. So what we're trying to move from Bitcoin's perspective is something to we call mass adoption, where it's Bitcoin itself is freely accessible across the world and can be also freely traded. But as we've seen, and you mentioned earlier as well, with what happened recently with MTI, specifically referring to fraud and not security hacks, what we've seen, not just MTI, but within South Africa, within other countries, a lot of scams coming into the lot of fraud taking place. So Bitcoin itself was designed to operate without this need for intermediaries such as a bank or such as central banks. But some people fail to see the fact that even though it was created to operate outside of these realms, we still need some form of regulation there. We can't operate in a world where it's completely chaotic and people's interests aren't protected, that players in the games aren't regulated either. So it comes back to the importance in any type of financial instrument or any type of commodity that we deal with, that we need to operate within this regulated space to make sure it's safe for the consumer as well to invest into cryptocurrencies and to do so safely. And that's why from a regulations perspective and also from a safety perspective, we need to make sure that customers' funds and customers' interests and all stakeholders alike is interest are looked after. And the only way that I believe that can be achieved within South Africa or internationally is by way of regulation.
Now, that brings us, buddy, to the issue of exchanges. Obviously very topical this week with Coinbase listing. And if you look at the numbers, some of them eye-wateringly large. Why do we need an intermediary in a space that is all about disintermediation? What is the role of the exchange? And what do you see Valour's role in this context here in South Africa?
So any cryptocurrency exchange like Valour.com has four main functions, where you are able to deposit different kinds of currencies, withdraw those currencies out of the platform, and trade them for each other. And so, for example, a customer on Valour.com can deposit Rand into the platform, convert that to Bitcoin or any other cryptocurrencies that we have on offer. And when and if they want to sell those cryptocurrencies, they're able to sell them for Rand and get it back into their bank account. So essentially, cryptocurrency exchanges are like Valour.com, bridge the gap between the traditional financial system, where we're dealing with fiat currency, to the new world of cryptocurrencies, where we make cryptocurrencies accessible to the common consumers.
And how, in effect, does that process work, converting rands into Bitcoin? Do you need market makers? How exactly does it work?
So we have market makers both on the buy side and the sell side of the cryptocurrency exchanges. But we also have lots and lots of customers. We have seen exponential growth in retail market as well as institutional interest in cryptocurrencies joining the platform. We started off with 1,000 users on the first day of launch, and now we have more than 100,000 users. So given that there are number of people trading day in and day out, and institutions trading and day in and day out, they use their normal banking system to deposit rands into their rand wallet on Valour.com. Once the rand shows up on their wallet, they can convert that using our exchange to Bitcoin or Ethereum or Ripple or any of the other cryptocurrencies on offer. And then based on when they want to sell it, if they sell it, it's converted again on the exchange because of the liquidity that is there. And then once they have rands back, we have banking rails for customers to withdraw their funds back into their banking account.
And Buddy, just to stay with you for a second longer, if you look at the Coinbase results, it's obvious that the middlemen in the crypto game are making much more money than the traditional banks. Some might argue offering far less of a service. What are the kinds of fees that are fair and reasonable in an environment like this, where there is still such light touch regulation? And what should investors be looking for and demanding when it comes to fees? And then, Anthony, maybe you can come at this from the asset manager perspective. But Bardi, firstly, as an exchange operator, how do you view it?
That is a very good question. If a consumer in South Africa today, for example, want to exchange their rands to US dollar, they have to go to a bank. And the bank usually charges anywhere from 1% to 2%. On that transaction value, which I personally think is quite unfair and exorbitant. And even if you consider Coinbase, which is charging about 0.5% of the transaction value on their trading fees, it is also quite high. So in fact, on Valour.com provides one of the cheapest trading fees in the world. In fact, we also have something called the maker fees. We pay the consumers back if they provide liquidity on our exchange. So before Valour.com came into the picture, SA, South Africa, was one of the most expensive places to buy cryptocurrencies. But I think we've seen more competitive pricing coming up in South Africa. Just to give you the numbers, we have trading fees at about 1.1% of the trade value on the exchange. And if you are a maker on the exchange, we pay you 0.01% back to the customers. And we've got very good feedback on the kind of fee structure that we have created for our customers, and they seem fair in my view, and as well as from the customer's point of view.
And how do you look at the fees perspective from an asset manager perspective? Through that lens, what are you looking for as a fair and reasonable fee for the various services that crypto exchange offers?
Well, Michael, we're active managers, and our top fee, we have a fee ladder, a scale, and our top fee is 1%. So I work a whole year to earn 1%, and anyone who charges 1%, within a few split seconds, will have my criticism. That being said, we are in the nascent phase of these on-ramps and off-ramps, so they will charge as much as they can get away with until competition sorts that out. I remember the early days of Luno, when they would charge north of 1%, and as competitors like Valour have stepped in, Luno have responded. So I think that competitive forces will take care of that. And like any industry, people will charge as much as they can get away with. I think as we go forward and the volumes increase, charging lower fees with higher volumes will make sense to the exchanges. And I don't see this really as a point of contention.
The one point of contention at the moment, though, certainly isn't the single point of failure for centralized exchanges. And we've seen it with MTI. We're seeing the early stages, although it is a developing story, we must stress, on ICE3, and we're still trying to get to the bottom of that. Although a quick Google map search of the registered head office has it registered as a nursery school. So unless a nursery school is renting out some office space to Mr. Grobler, there are some red flags. How do you go about doing your due diligence as an investor in this space?
Yes, Mike. So you touched on a few things there, and I'm just going to address all of them. Mirror Trading was not an exchange. It was really just a multi-level marketing scheme. This is as old as the hills. And they use crypto to peddle. ICE was an exchange. It was actually one of the first exchanges in South Africa. It's been going for a while. I did sign up to do some due diligence on it. I was just curious, simply because they boasted to have the first crypto debit card, which didn't really live up to its promise. I noticed that the volumes on ICE were very thinly traded. And yes, I also noticed that they had a registered office in Klerksdorp, which I had to look up on a map. And then the executive team sitting in the UK were things that just didn't add up for me. Larger exchanges are obviously the ones that will have a bigger balance sheet. They'll have more liquidity. They'll be able to staff better professionals. So, as with any exchange, you're always better off going to the most liquid and more secure exchange. But on the topic of exchange, crypto investors can hold their crypto on exchange, which comes with risks. And I think that's something that people really need to be educated on. Or they can keep it off exchange. I keep my crypto, my family's crypto, off exchange, because an exchange is a central point of failure, like we've seen with ICE3. We will see the rise of decentralized exchanges. Currently, the biggest one is Uniswap. And these act like virtual exchanges. They bring together buyers and sellers on a platform that has the look and feel of an exchange, but there is no custodian where people keep their wallets on exchange. The reason you'd want to keep crypto on an exchange wallet is to firstly save on fees, because it costs you to move your crypto from your exchange wallet to your private wallet. And secondly, to react very quickly to market prices. For instance, we've seen this time and again when there is huge spike or volatility in the Bitcoin price, the network gets congested, and you could wait up to hours or days to move your crypto at a reasonable price and then to exchange it. So those are the trade-offs.
Very interesting, and some points, buddy, that I want to come back to you to respond to. But firstly, Vian, from a regulatory perspective, what sort of regulation do you see being introduced to help overcome issues around fraud in particular that we are seeing in the space?
Yeah, look, so from the perspective of putting regulations in place to actually monitor these virtual asset service providers or anyone providing advice, I think perhaps let me just the individuals actually, or the virtual asset service provider itself. If cryptocurrency is falls under the definition of a financial asset according to the FIC, then it should be regulated by an institution like the FSCA. Now, from that perspective, that will assist greatly, because if you think about it, these virtual asset service providers also already have regulations that they need to adhere to, which include, of course, the Companies Act. Now, if we just look at the Companies Act for interest sake, it's quite interesting that the Companies Act already says that if you hold assets in a fiduciary capacity in excess of 5 million rand, then you need to be audited. In addition to this, it also has this thing called the public interest score. Now, the public interest score is used to calculate the actual public interest score of the company. And it takes into account also the liabilities and the stakeholders involved. Now, if you have any investment platform or virtual asset service provider, actually you have customers investing into you, you have that corresponding liability on your balance sheet. And that liability should be included into your public interest score. And once that reaches a threshold of 350, you're also required to be audited. So from those two already regulations put out there in the Companies Act, there is this regulation for virtual asset service providers to actually be audited. Now, once monitored and regulated by another institution as well, let's say, for example, the FSCA, usually require these financial statements to be audited within a three-month period and be audited with credible auditors as well. So from that perspective, you can even look from an MTI's perspective, have a look at when MTI was incorporated, when it started trading. The directors, of course, didn't appoint an auditor as they should have, but there was no monitoring of that. Now, had it been appointed, it would have been picked up, an auditor would have been appointed. Had the company actually gone through audit, they will be required to submit audited financial statements, and it could have limited these masses and masses losses by these stakeholders. And I mean, from an auditor's perspective, there's no way possible if an institution such as MTI comes with a business case and say, this is how we generate our income, and reading through it and doing that due diligence, it just didn't make any sense whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So from that perspective, that's where and how regulations will assist us in actually growing this industry and just making it safer for individuals to operate in, and getting right players in the game and weeding out these bad apples. And also taking into account people from an advisory perspective. It's still unregulated, so there is masses and masses of people giving advice on cryptocurrencies, and we all know how volatile this can be. So there's no one sitting with a glass ball saying this is what we expect the Bitcoin price to do in the near future. It just can't be done. And that's why we need that protection for people not actually giving individuals advice that's shoddy or doesn't make any commercial sense whatsoever.
It's just such a fast-moving area, as Anthony Rocky just described. We're moving away from centralized to decentralized exchanges already. And so for regulators to keep up, it's often very difficult. Buddy, from your perspective, I know the SARB has got regulatory sandboxes and is trying to be very proactive with the existing larger players in the market. How do you see, or how would you like to see the regulatory environment evolve in order to, on the one hand, provide confidence, but on the other, also not throttle the innovation that has made the asset class so attractive?
Yes, Michael. Before my co-founders and I started Vada, we actually went to the regulators and said, please regulate us. But at the time, there was no regulatory framework to regulate any of the cryptocurrency exchanges. So we started off with what we call self-regulation. So all the customers on our platform are fully KYC. So they cannot trade a single rand before they are fully KYC. We have checks in place for anti-money laundering and sanctions checks and so on. So Valor has been ready for regulation from day one. So we have regular check-ins with the regulators at the moment. And as you said, the sandbox is coming up, and a few white papers have been proposed for public comment by the regulators. Any day now, there will be a confirmation of the regulatory framework, and we have been ready for that from the day one. The other point I wanted to just touch on is the from the consumer's point of view, there needs to be some kind of due diligence before they put their money into any platform. So they need to look at the team behind the company, the investors. For example, we have investors like Michael Jordan, who was ex-CEO of FNB, 4DI Capital, which is based out of Cape Town.
Justin Stanford,
We went through a lot of scrutiny when we raised 57 million rand from our investors last year in June. And I think we welcome public scrutiny into our team, into the company, before any customer put their money into the platform. So I think there needs to be regulations that we are welcoming, and also from a consumer's point of view, research and due diligence.
Caveat hodler, as they say in the parlance. And we've got a couple of minutes left. There was a very interesting, and I just wanted to touch on this and get away perhaps from the regulation, just in conclusion, very interesting cover of Time magazine in March. Is fiat dead? It just read in big, bold, black letters on the cover of Time magazine. Is this the end of fiat?
No, Michael, it's not the end of fiat. I do, however, think that the central banks have set fiat on a course which is very difficult to reverse. And I think that people are looking for different ways to hedge. Therefore, that's why we're seeing the likes of cryptocurrencies stepping in like I said in the beginning of this this discussion, Bitcoin to me represents digitized scarcity. We live in a world where everything's being digitized. You get into an Uber, why? And you trust your life with a complete stranger. Why? Because the trust has been digitized. You sleep in a stranger's house, thank you to Airbnb, because the trust around that and the feedback loops that have been set in place means that there's been a digitization of trust. So this is part of a bigger, broader trend that we've witnessed, and nation states will respond with their own versions of crypto, and these will be digital currencies.
Yep.
It brings with it a measure of intrusiveness that I don't think everybody will welcome. But at the same time, it also brings with it tools for central banks to pinpoint where they would want capital or financial help to flow. If everybody has a digital wallet and the central banks know which are the productive members of society or that people that need the capital the most, given a specific financial crisis, then reacting by way of loan or by way of QE to specific parts of the market rather than just some blanket program like we have right now, which only seem to benefit the haves and the people that are invested in the market.
Yep.
And don't really hit Main Street, then I think this is a cause for good.
Well, you've left on such an interesting point there. We're going to have a follow-up conversation as China is toying with a digital currency to help penalize people for not spending, maybe stimulating economic activity in certain sectors, which to my mind raises all kinds of dystopian nightmares. But I get your point. That is a far more efficient way, potentially, of ensuring that monetary policy has its desired effect. On that point, we're going to have to leave it there. Fascinating roundtable on the parabolic rise of cryptocurrencies. Bitcoin trading at just over $60,000 a Bitcoin. I think it was just over $10,000 a little over a year ago. That was Buddy Sukaram, who's the co-founder and chief product officer of Valar.com, who's joined by Anthony Rocky, co-founder of Rexilom Invest, a boutique asset manager, and Vian Urifir, partner at the audit division of Mazars in South Africa. As I said earlier, in cryptos, it's caveat hodler.